Please be seated. Well, good afternoon. My notes tell me that we may have students from Madison's La Follette High School. If they are here, would they please stand? Very nice. Thank you. You can be seated. Is this a special class that you're here for? What is it? Say it again. Ah, very good. Well, we're in favor of that class. It brings you all to court. We certainly like to have student visitors come to class. This is part of a program that we run in combination with the State Bar of Wisconsin, so I know the students have had an opportunity to learn a little bit about the case you're going to tell us about today. With that little bit of preliminary information, I'll call the last.
Did you get a copy of the summary of the facts and law of the case?
That's yes,
what the reference
that's right.
Is.
Yes, that's correct. Okay, so I will call our last case for the day, State versus Monahan. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
I'm Andrew Hinkle from the State Public Defender Appellate Office. I represent Mr. Monahan, and may it please the court. I'd like to start today by talking a little bit about the facts here before proceeding on to the more legal issue in the case. I don't think there's a great disagreement between the state and Mr. Monahan about what the record shows. It's more a matter of emphasis. So the state, of course, needed to show the only thing that they really needed to show in this case was that Mr. Monahan was the driver in the car at the time that it crashed. And to do that, first of all, they used Mr. Monahan's statements. They presented the statements that he made in the minutes after the crash and within a few hours of the crash. Obviously, in those statements, Mr. Monahan at various times said that he had been the driver. But there was reason to doubt those statements. For one, he was intoxicated. Second, he was heavily concussed. He had been knocked unconscious for some period of at least several minutes. And the third thing is that he had been sort of fed some information about what had happened by one of the officers that questioned him, basically told him you were the driver, to which he agreed. It was only after that he began saying that. The state also sought and received a report from a state trooper, an expert report. That trooper examined the physical evidence around the crash and came to the conclusion that he believed that it established that Mr. Monahan had been the driver. But Mr. Monahan, of course, got his own expert who questioned some of those conclusions, pointed out some errors in the report, and said, hey, there's really no way to tell, based on this evidence, who was driving this car, certainly not beyond reasonable doubt. The state pointed to the DNA evidence. There was a lot of the inside of the car was searched, or swabbed for DNA. The only place that they could find any was on the airbag of the driver's side steering wheel. And that airbag had the DNA of two people on it. One could be identified as Mr. Monahan and the other couldn't be identified. Given that there were two people in the car, Mr. Monahan's expert opined, hey, it seems likely that the other DNA on the driver's side airbag is Ms. Cushman's DNA.
Counsel, all of the non-testimonial evidence, I think, as you say, lends itself to potentially coming to two different conclusions about who was driving. But there is testimonial evidence, and you mentioned it at the beginning of your argument. Why does that not dispose of this? And I know what you say about concussed and intoxicated, but you know, some of this was, he said, after he'd been assessed neurologically and found to be oriented times three and scored the highest on the Glasgow score. He said that he remembered the accident, and then he said he was driving. So why does that not end the inquiry?
I mean, I'd certainly agree, Justice Kelly, that that is evidence against Mr. Monahan. It's evidence from which a jury could conclude that he had been the driver. I push back a little bit on the meaning of the Glasgow coma score in this instance. It's not as if it declares all your faculties to be intact. It's a way of saying you're conscious. You're not, you know, one end is coma, the other end is fully conscious. Mm-hmm. He was fully conscious when he made these statements. That's what that says.
Yeah. And oriented times three, right? So time, place, and oriented times three. So that's time, place, and person.
Sure. Right? He knew who he was. He knew where he was.
And when and all that. And said that he remembered the accident.
He did say that. Again, he had been told what had happened in the accident. The details that he gave, I mean, in many ways, they're not unique, and they're almost sort of obvious about what had happened. I mean, the car left the road. It ended up in a cornfield, so we know that it left the road.
Right, but this is not just some third-party witness testifying about what he saw. This is him saying of himself,
absolutely.
I was driving.
And I mean, if the confession of a defendant were always 100% accurate, then I would accept your conclusion. But we know that not to be the case. And in any case, it was up to the jury to decide whether they were going to credit that testimony or not. And they certainly could have. But they could also not have. And then the state also presented other evidence, which I guess I sort of view as less compelling. That is the evidence of the position that the driver's seat was in and the passenger seat were in after the crash and during the crash. I saw the picture that that Mr. Castle put in his brief. That looks like a pretty normal driving position to me. He apparently sees it differently. But in any case, I think that circumstantial evidence makes a fairly minimal contribution to the state's burden of proof here. And the state, besides all of these kind of things that could go either way, they had a problem, which is that we had eyewitnesses who placed Ms. Cushman behind the wheel of this car within 10, 15 minutes of the time the crash happened. And we also knew, based on the GPS evidence, that if she was behind the wheel of that car, she was driving it at 105, I think topped out about 105, but very high speeds within a few minutes of this crash occurring. So what did the state do? Well, it did two things. First, it came up with this argument that, hey, the car stopped for 2 minutes in Schulzburg. So at that time, they could have switched places. The driver could have become the passenger and vice versa.
Is there any evidence to support that assertion?
Which position?
That they could have switched.
Well, the car was stopped, so I mean...
I mean, did anyone see it? Is there any reason to believe that it occurred other than the car was stopped?
No, I don't believe there is. The part of the investigation was that they sought, you know, security camera footage from establishments that were on the route, but they just couldn't find anything that showed anyone driving the car. I don't think they could find the car at all. And the other thing the state did was fight tooth and nail to exclude the evidence about how fast the car had been going before this 2 minute stop in Schulzburg, both on the way from their initial place they started to the Leahy party, and then from the Leahy party to the stop in Schulzburg immediately before the crash. They fought it. There was litigated over multiple hearings. You know, there was multiple filings, and you know, they fought very hard to exclude it, and they succeeded. And then in closing argument, of course, they used the exclusion of that evidence to say, hey, there's no way Ms. Cushman could possibly have driven this way, would have driven this way. And now they're here in this court saying, well, it didn't matter.
There's no way that she could have driven that way because of what?
Because she was a stranger to the area. She was visiting Wisconsin from somewhere on the East Coast. And that was essentially the argument. And she was also intoxicated. And so the prosecutor said, no intoxicated person would drive unfamiliar roads in the way that this car was driven.
Kind of next assumes that the intoxicated person will make a good choice, right?
Yes, it certainly does. I want to shift a little bit to the discussion of what it means to do harmless error in a case where you...
Yeah, before you do that, just to tie up a loose end, was there anything in the trial or in the record, more importantly, that would call into question the admissions that Mr. Monahan had made about driving? Was there any expert testimony? Did he say I was under duress? Was there anything like that?
I mean, I think the jury heard information about his injuries, his concussion, and his intoxication. Was there expert testimony saying sometimes people with concussions are confused or say things that aren't true? No, there was not. However, I think that's a matter of common sense. I mean, I think it's a matter of common knowledge that people with a concussion are often confused. Sometimes they have memories of things that didn't happen. I've had, you know, multiple family members who've had that happen, where hours after a concussion, they were coming up with false theories about how this concussion happened.
And was that asserted in this case, or is that just something that we all know?
I think that's a matter, again, I think that's a matter of common knowledge. We all saw the Wisconsin football player go and try and play for the wrong team after a hard hit a couple of years ago.
Okay, but there's nothing in the record to that effect.
No, there certainly was no expert testimony like that.
Well, counsel, there's no expert testimony, but there is actually the testimony of your client, right? His initial response to law enforcement when questioned about what had happened, didn't he say he didn't know if he was driving or who was driving or who was in the car or what had happened?
Yeah, he said that repeatedly. He didn't know where he was. He said he had been coming from the place where he, in fact, had not been coming from. He said that they had been wearing their seatbelts. That was also not true. So I guess that's in part a response to your question as well. There was evidence that his statements were unreliable, and at least in some ways. And he, you know, as he was fed information about the crash, once he learned there was a female in the car, he said, "Well, then probably I was driving," or something to that effect. Initially, he didn't know if there had been anyone else in the car.
The way I read the evidence, and like both counsel to comment on it, he initially said, "I don't know." Then he said, "I guess so, I think so, maybe." And then only later on, when he was at the hospital, he wrote a statement saying he was driving.
Well, on the scene, when the second time that the Deputy Gorham came over to him, I believe that's the name, Deputy Gorham came over, having spoken with him once, and then he came over with a tape recorder or something, and that was actually played for the jury. And in that's the exchange in which the deputy says, "Hey, a firefighter saw you driving the car out of Shellsburg, so you were the driver, right?" To which Kyle responds something like, "I guess so," or "maybe," or something like that. And then the officer says, "You're not BSing me or anything, right?" To which Mr. Monahan says, "I don't think so." So that was the first time that he affirmatively said he had been driving, and that was the context in which that occurred.
So there was no firefighter?
There was never any evidence that this firefighter existed, except I agree with the state that that deputy did testify at trial that firefighter had said that. But he apparently interviewed a couple of firefighters. It was made an issue of, and the state never produced this firefighter who supposedly saw this. So turning to, I guess, the dispute over what this court's job is in applying harmless error, I don't think anybody can disagree that when an appellate court finds harmless error in a case that's been tried to a jury, what they're doing, what an appellate court is doing in that context, is making a decision that's ordinarily reserved for a jury. The jury has not heard all the evidence that this court decides it should have heard, and what the court's decision is what would that jury have done? Can we be certain, beyond reasonable doubt, that no reasonable jury could have found reasonable doubt? It's a little bit of a mouthful, but I think that's what the test is.
The test is, again, and from what case?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly stated in Nader and Chapman that the inquiry is, could a reasonable jury have found otherwise? Which, I guess to me that, and it's also stated that the burden to show harmlessness is on the state beyond a reasonable doubt. So when you put those two things together, the state has the obligation to show beyond a reasonable doubt that no reasonable jury with this new evidence could have reasonable doubt about Mr. Monahan's guilt.
You know, the statement out of Hunt that I had found persuasive said, in harmless error, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not, quote, contribute to the verdict.
Yeah,
is yours the same as that or different than that?
I think those are two ways of saying the same thing, because if the error did not contribute to the verdict, mm-hmm. that means that had the error not occurred, we can say with confidence that the verdict would be the same, right? Does that make
mm-hmm.
sense? And
yeah,
I think that's the same
sense.
Thing as saying that no mm-hmm. reasonable jury could find otherwise. And the state's brief in response to my argument about this court having an obligation to consider reasonable inferences that the jury could draw that were unfavorable to the state and favorable to Mr. Monahan, they say I'm wrong, and they don't really provide any sort of signposts or description of how that decision is supposed to be made. And I think if you read their presentation of the evidence, it becomes clear that what they're doing is essentially saying, you know, here's the evidence we like the most. It's better than Mr. Monahan's evidence, so harmless error. And if you look at the cases that they cite for harmless error, you can see that those cases are radically different than the kind of thing that we've got going on here. They cite Anthony, and that was a case in which the defendant wanted to testify, basically wouldn't abide by evidentiary rules or pretrial rulings, and so the judge didn't let him testify. What he wanted to testify to was that he had killed the victim in self-defense. He had stabbed the victim 50 times with an ice pick. He had told people beforehand that he was going to kill the victim because he thought she was cheating on him. And there was evidence that the victim had a medical condition that would have prevented her from attacking him in any way that would necessitate self-defense. In Nelson, the defendant wanted to get on the stand and confess, wanted to get on the stand and say she had done all of the elements of the crime. Obviously, in that instance, there's no way that testimony could have created a reasonable doubt in the minds of a jury. In fact, this court said there was not a shred of evidence in her favor, and I think that stands in stark contrast to this case. There is evidence in Mr. Monahan's favor. In Hale, some testimony about where the defendant had gotten a gun that was used in the commission of the offense, when and where he had gotten a gun, was brought in that shouldn't have been brought in. But there was no dispute that he had the gun. That was not his defense. His defense was an alibi defense. I wasn't there. It was an uncontested element. And so, of course, introducing evidence that shouldn't have been introduced couldn't have made a difference. It wouldn't change the jury verdict. It wouldn't change reasonable doubt.
What are we doing with this case? As question mark. As I understand it, both sides acknowledged there was error. The question is it harmless? Is the real question that we have to decide is how to correctly articulate the standard? Or that's why I asked kind of generically, what do you think we're doing with this case?
I think there's an aspect of the standard that, yes, needs to be clarified. And that is, how is a reviewing appellate court to treat factual evidence in a jury trial? I mean, there's no way to look at all of the evidence in a 7-day trial and come to one right answer without having some sort of decision-making rules.
So is there anything wrong with what we said in Hunt?
I'm sorry?
Is there anything wrong with what we said in Hunt as far as how to identify harmless error?
That is, whether you can be clear beyond reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict.
Right.
I think that's true as long as we understand that to mean, I guess I see that as logically equivalent to the other formulation. So, yeah, I agree that, no, I don't think there's anything wrong with what you said in Hunt.
All right, so...
Although I'm not familiar with the facts of that case, so I should...
Sure. Yeah, but just as a standard, that's as a equation, that's how we identify what harmless error is, right?
I don't really care what formulation the court uses in saying what a harmless error is. What I care about is how it evaluates, again, evidence that can raise conflicting inferences in a jury trial.
Right. So your primary concern here is that we would recognize that if you can draw two or more inferences from a fact, that we read those inferences most favorable to the defendant.
That's right. And I think specifically with a focus on the error, and I guess more precisely, with a focus on what would have been different had the error not occurred. That is, usually evidence either would have come in or evidence would have been kept out.
So when we're analyzing the effect of that, excluded evidence or included evidence, whichever way, and we look at the different inferences that could carry, we say, well, let's look at the inferences in the way that makes it most likely it would have affected the verdict, right? And then we decide if it's harmless. So your case is really about inferences.
I agree. I mean, I think that's the distinction between what I view the harmless error test as requiring and how it's, frankly, you often see it applied in the real world, which is that a court says, there's enough here to convict him, and so we're confident that it's okay.
Is there anything that we've said in any of our prior cases that suggests that we would not do that?
I don't think there's anything in your cases that is contrary to the ideas that I'm saying here. I think that in this case, I don't think you can come to the conclusion that it was a harmless error without applying the law in a way that I view as incorrect, without sort of saying, the state's evidence, you know, we're more convinced by the state's evidence, therefore the error is harmless. I don't think that's the proper standard. I don't think you've ever said it was the proper standard, but I think there's a danger. You know, an appellate court needs to be sure they're giving very rigorous thought to what are the possibilities here. Because a jury, of course, is free to draw whatever reasonable inferences it likes. So the fact that you or I may think, this evidence is more convincing than that evidence, that really doesn't answer the question.
So you're just saying that the appellate court does not weigh the evidence one against the other. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I think that there, you know, obviously when you're looking at a really complicated evidentiary picture, evidence has all sorts of effects on other evidence, right? I mean, logically, and just, you know, sometimes it's contradictory, sometimes it casts evidence in a different light. And the court has to have all that in mind, and I don't envy the task, because I think it's analytically complicated. I'm having a hard time, I guess, I've had a hard time in preparation coming to an idea of just what I think the test is. But I think to the extent that the evidence requires weighing, or to the extent that inferences can go either way, you have to say, well, if an inference could go in favor of the defendant, it's not for us, the appellate court, to say, we don't really like that inference, because that is for the jury. The jury is free to make that reasonable inference. And if you don't let them do it, then you're stepping into the shoes of the jury.
Well, on pages 24 and 25 of your brief, Mr. Hinkle, you say that this is what harmless error is. Instead of asking whether a jury reasonably could find guilt, it must be determined beyond a reasonable doubt whether a jury would find guilt in the absence of error. And that to find a trial error harmless, an appellate court must be convinced there's no set of reasonable inferences a jury can draw that would create a reasonable doubt of guilt. So what does the appellate court look at all this evidence and say, okay, we're now a reasonable jury and decide what kind of inferences the jury can draw?
I guess I don't think
that they're... Look at all this evidence again as a jury would?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
And look at all this evidence as a jury would?
I mean, I think the task is sort of one level of abstraction higher than that. That is, the court doesn't say, you know, from this evidence I draw this conclusion. The court says, from this evidence, these conclusions are possible. Is there a conclusion that is reasonable? Not just possible, but reasonable. Is there a reasonable conclusion that would allow a jury to have reasonable doubt? Specifically, again, I emphasize, as Mr. Hanek said in his brief, with reference to the error. That is, does the presence of this error, would the correction of this error give rise to reasonable inferences that could either form a reasonable doubt in a juror's mind or take a doubt that was kind of like, not quite a reasonable doubt and give the juror a little more courage to say, you know, maybe Mr. Monahan is guilty of this, but I have doubt about it. And I think that's the test. That's the court's job.
Counsel, you and the amicus have asserted that we should look at the evidence in a light most favorable to your client. Are you basing that assertion on some logical inference from the case law, or do we have any cases that actually said that?
I don't think this court has any cases that sort of explore this issue in real depth. I think it is quite clearly implicit in the formulations of the harmless error test, where we're asking what a reasonable jury could do or would do. Obviously, again, a reasonable jury is free to draw reasonable inferences in any direction. And so when you're asking what they reasonably could do, you have to ask, could they draw inferences in favor of the defendant? But no, there's not a case right on point. In fact, I looked all over the country, and the courts really, I'm not saying, you know, that the law is against me. I'm saying this is not sort of an issue that's been really sussed out a lot in appellate decisions. There's some law review articles talking about it. I think I cite one or two in my brief. I think maybe Mr. Hennick does too. But no, there's not. What I'm basing it on is this court's statement and the United States Supreme Court's formulations of what the harmless error test means.
So is it could do or would do?
Pardon me?
Is the test what a reasonable jury could do or would do. Those are two different standards.
Right, and I think you can say either one depending on how you're formulating it, right? So if we're saying, if we're speaking in the negative and saying it's a harmless error if no reasonable jury could find for the defendant, I think that's a correct statement. I also think it's correct to say, let me take a minute. In order to find an error harmless, the court must be convinced that any reasonable jury would find for the state. It's sort of like the difference between the could and would that we have in the jury instructions for proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Are you advocating that the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant? Or are you advocating that any reasonable inferences drawn must be viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant? And is there a difference?
I guess I'm not sure what the difference would be. I think when we're viewing light, when we're viewing evidence in a light, favorable or on, we're taking, you know, the bare facts, the testimony, whatever else, and we're saying, what does this mean? And of course, a lot of evidence, a lot of statements, a lot of evidence admits of multiple possible meanings. And so, and what those multiple possible meanings are is inferences. So I think to look at the evidence most in a light most favorable to the defendant means to draw reasonable inferences in the defendant's favor.
The amicus brief adopts the Chapman standard and says that the beneficiary of a constitutional error, and I'm not sure that doesn't apply to all errors, the beneficiary of a constitutional error has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained. That's the Chapman one. And here the state would be the beneficiary of an error.
That's correct. The burden is on the state just as it was at trial.
If we adopt that, then the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of didn't contribute to the verdict obtained. Now, I don't know how a court can decide that without weighing all the evidence.
First of all, I see my red light is on.
You can answer the question.
May.
Yes, please.
I guess when we say weigh the evidence, again, I've been here before arguing about what weigh the evidence means. And I think that...
Consider the evidence pro and against.
Right. So, I don't think it would be proper for a court to declare an error harmless, for example, where you have two different witnesses giving conflicting testimony. And there'd be few cases in which, you know, perhaps there'd be a situation in which one witness was just so incredible or contrary to the facts that we knew. But in general, no, I think those credibility calls are for the jury, and so a court should be mindful of a jury's obligation and power and responsibility to be the one who decides who's telling the truth.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. The issue in this case is whether the exclusion of evidence about the speed of the vehicle involved in this fatal crash in the final segment of its travel was harmless error. The State asked the Court to hold that the error was harmless under the well-established standards for making that legal determination.
You agree that there was error here?
Yes, the state
has
not contested the...
That's a question of law, though.
I'm sorry?
That's whether it was properly excluded is a question of law.
Correct. The court is not bound by the state's concession, but the state has not contested the exclusion was erroneous.
You said the exclusion of evidence of speed at the time of the crash.
I'm sorry. In the segment... Prior to the crash, there was evidence admitted. There were three segments.
Maybe you should just go through what exactly was excluded.
There was a GPS in the car. From the GPS data, The crash reconstructionists on both sides were able to calculate the speed of the vehicle, first from the time the car left Schulzburg to go to the Leahy party. That was excluded. Next, from the Leahy party back to Schulzburg, where there was a two-minute stop, that evidence was excluded. What was admitted was the evidence of the speed from the time of the stop in Schulzburg after the party until the crash a few minutes later. That was the only evidence that was admitted.
And the defense theory would have been that if he could have admitted that evidence, he would have been able to show the driving was consistent throughout and it was deceased that was driving. It's hard to hear today.
I'm having a hard time hearing you over the background.
Right, I know. His theory, well, just it's easier if you just talk, probably. What was the theory of defense and how this excluded evidence played into it?
As Mr. Monahan has argued it in his brief, he contends that that evidence shows that the victim, Ms. Cushman, was driving. And I think that significantly overstates the significance of the evidence. It shows whoever was driving very fast, and that's all that it shows.
Doesn't he tie that in, though, with the closing argument of the state, wherein the state said something like, it couldn't have been her because she's an out-of-towner and she wasn't familiar enough with the roads to be driving at such an excessive speed. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but that's really why this becomes, that's why, in part, this becomes poignant evidence.
I will agree with you that the fact that the state made that argument is something that adds some weight to Mr. Monahan's harmless error argument. But if you look at what the special prosecutor said, even in this section where she's talking about using common sense, she's not just talking about the speed. She's saying, use your common sense. Mr. Monahan is from this area. He's testified that he's driven this road many times. It's common sense that he would be the one driving. Now, to that he added, it's also common sense that Ms. Cushman would not have been driving at that speed, being unfamiliar. So even within the context of the remarks, this look at this with common sense, this was only a part of it. And then the prosecutor said, but you don't have to rely on your common sense. Let's look at what the evidence shows. And then the prosecutor went through the evidence that, in the state's view, establishes a very strong case. Now, some of the evidence is more, if it were the only evidence, such as the battling expert's opinion about who got ejected from the car, who was driving. If that's all we had, then it would be hard for the state to argue that there was harmless error. But we have very important other evidence. The statements, and I want to take issue with opposing counsel's statement that the people on the scene fed Mr. Monahan information about what happened. I want to make sure I get this correct. In the cornfield, before anybody said anything to him about the firefighter, the Schulzburg firefighter who found Mr. Monahan asked him several times who was driving. Mr. Monahan says, I was driving, I guess. Now, after that, he a couple of times said he didn't know. Then, as one of the deputies approaches Mr. Monahan, when Mr. Monahan is on the side of the road, he overhears Mr. Monahan say, that's the last time I will ever drink and drive. When Deputy Gorham spoke to Mr. Monahan, he spoke to him twice. The first time, when he asked Mr. Monahan who the driver was, Mr. Monahan said, I might have been, I guess. Then the deputy was told to get a reported statement. That's when the deputy says that the firefighter had said that a man was driving. Monahan says, I guess I was driving. And then, I think this is really important in terms of this theory of what was fed to Mr. Monahan. The deputy asked Mr. Monahan how the crash occurred. And Monahan said, my tires went off the side of the road. I believe it was I lost control. That was the officer's recollection. The jury heard the recording, and it shows that Mr. Monahan said, I just effing my tires going off. I just remember effing my tires going off the edge. I could not correct it. Now, nobody said anything to Mr. Monahan about that, but that's really important because both reconstruction experts for the state and Mr. Monahan agreed that that's how.
In other words, did the physical evidence match that statement?
Yes, the physical evidence showed tire skid marks going off the right side of the shoulder before the car then veered back across the road. It would appear to have been an overcorrection. So Mr. Monahan said, I remember my tires going off the edge, and I couldn't correct it. Nobody fed him that information.
Counselor, would you agree that as we're looking at harmless error, some evidence as it comes in is totally independent, and other evidence when it comes in either supports or undermines other evidence?
Correct.
I'd like you to consider the evidence that was excluded of the driving. And I ask you, doesn't that support the statement of Mr. Monahan's two witnesses who said that the deceased was driving and he was in the passenger seat?
It supports it very slightly because, I want to make...
Well, it would, if it supports it, would also permit him to have argued to the jury, yeah, the car was going really, really fast, but it was going really, really fast in this period too, and that would support the witness's testimony that he was not the driver, but was a passenger.
That he was not the driver on the segment from the party to Schulzburg. Correct.
That's true. And the question was, of course, who was the driver? Was it the same person, or was it not the same person between Schulzburg and the moment of the crash?
Correct.
But it would allow defense counsel to argue there's a continuum here of speed, and it would have precluded the prosecutor from arguing, oh, she didn't live there. She never would have driven that fast because she was driving really fast.
I agree. But when we – before I talk about why I think it also was harmless error because it would have had no impact on all the evidence I'm talking about. It would have had no evidence on Mr. Monahan's statement. It would have had no impact on the evidence of the driver's seat, which I'll get to because I think that's very important evidence. Opposing counsel discounts it. I just want to take a moment. I noticed in preparation I made a factual error in my brief, and I want to take this opportunity to correct it. In my brief, at page 30, footnote 5, I said that Mr. Monahan was the only witness to testify that Ms. Cushman was driving when they arrived at the Leahy party. In preparing for the argument, I noticed I'm wrong. Mr. Leahy himself testified that Ms. Cushman was driving when they got to the party. So I don't think it has any bearing on the argument, but I didn't want to leave that error in my brief uncorrected.
Counsel, before you get to what you really want to get to, opposing counsel speaks of inferences that are viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant. And that seems, I'm looking for some law here, right? And that seems like a reasonable statement of law. It seems reasonable to me for this reason, and then I want you to tell me, you know, if I'm right or wrong. It seems reasonable to me because, as previously referenced, you, the state, have the burden. Chapman standard requires the beneficiary of an error, a constitutional error, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained. Whatever the precise wording of the standard, the point that I am emphasizing is you have the burden to prove, because you're the beneficiary of the error, that it was no big deal. How's that? Now, if inferences were drawn in the light most favorable to the state, that seems to me that would analytically reduce your burden, lighten your load. And the law is clear. It's on your shoulders. And so what's wrong with the premise that reasonable inferences have to be drawn in favor of the defendant?
There's several things wrong with it. As Mr. Nicol candidly acknowledged, there is no case. I did the same search for all federal and state cases. I don't find in who knows how many hundreds or thousands of reported cases that have dealt with harmless error.
Well, but my analysis, since we don't have cases, isn't it going to lighten your burden? And that can't be.
But I think in concluding this analysis, one of the established factors is the strength of this case. Now, if in doing this analysis, the court looks at all the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Monahan, I don't think there would be any error that would be harmless. And the reason I say that is Mr. Monahan argues, well, the jury could have concluded the crash reconstructionists were awash. The jury could have concluded all the statements were unreliable. The jury could have concluded the DNA didn't mean anything. The jury could have concluded the seat position evidence didn't really establish anything. So if that's the starting point from the analysis, taking all the evidence at the trial and saying, well, the jury could have acquitted him, and I agree, the jury could have acquitted him. So then I ask, what error wouldn't be harmless?
Well, I think he's saying would have when he says the positive. That goes back to you've been around a long time, and you know this court has struggled for a while with to a reasonable, you know, to possibility, then probability, Nader and Harvey and Chapman, etc. But your opposing counsel is landing on the, when stated in the positive, the would have. Would is comparable to probable according to our case. You think?
Well, I think the testimony is whether a reasonable jury would have. And so given that the strength of the state's case is an important component of that, and this court has recognized many times that the strength of the state's case in a particular case might be the most important part when considered against the error. I don't see how opposing counsel's suggested test squares with a long history of harmless error. Now, I guess I want to, you alluded to the history of harmless error analysis in this court, and there was a time we started back in the Dyess case when the court adapted the Chapman formulation of whether the error contributed to the verdict, whether there's a reasonable possibility. Then we had Harvey, which adopted the Nader formulation of whether it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt a reasonable jury would have come to the same conclusion. We had a period where there was, let me say, some infighting among the members of the court.
And then we said, regardless of what standard, it's harmless or not harmless. And,
but lately, the court has resolved that by saying, these are alternate articulations of the same standard. And the state is perfectly content with that and has no interest in reopening that debate. I want to
just so there's no question, where in the brief or would you restate the two articulations that are the same, please?
I'm sorry.
I want you to re-articulate the two standards that you view the same or point to the language in the brief.
I'll point to this court's decision last term in State v. Steets.
Okay.
The court said that an error is harmless, quote, if it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have come to the same conclusion absent the error, or if it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained. So I think that is the court's most recent articulation, and in effect is saying there's two ways of saying the same thing. I want to mention what I think is really important evidence that is completely unaffected by, I don't think there's any possible basis to argue that the excluded evidence would have affected that. And I think it's powerful evidence, and that's the position of the seats. We have undisputed evidence that the seat was in the same position after the crash as it would have been before the crash. There was expert testimony by the state's expert, not challenged by the defense expert, that the seat would not have moved position. It was a power seat. The power was cut. There are other explanations of why the seat is designed not to move in an accident. The seat was in a position such that when a model the size of Ms. Cushman sat in that seat, reproduced that picture in the brief. The model was sitting. The model could reach the steering wheel, could reach the pedals, but was sitting in what I think most reasonable observers would say is an unnatural position driving. And more importantly, there was the testimony of the victim's mother who said, Rebecca always sat as close to the wheel, steering wheel, as possible. She was shown that picture, and she said, Rebecca does not drive in that position. I think that's really powerful evidence.
Rebecca was pretty tall, though. You know, I'm only 5'3". She was 5'6", or
she's
7", correct?
So Mr. Monahan is 5'1". But
he was 6'1", you mean.
Excuse me?
6'1", not 5'1".
6'1", yes. Yeah. But it's the relative positions, and with the seat in that position, though she was about 5'6", she would have had to have had her hands in a position that not only, I don't think a reasonable juror looking at that would have thought that's the way someone drives, especially not after hearing the testimony from her mother that she always drove as close to the steering wheel as possible.
How valuable is that? Both of their blood alcohol contents showed them quite inebriated. It shows that if she was driving, she was likely driving in not her normal position.
Yes, yeah. That's right. If she was driving, she was driving not in her normal position.
The testimony that was received after the defense expert was called, the mother testified on rebuttal, Rebecca never would have driven like that.
Right.
That was the testimony that was.
That's correct. And I understand Justice Bradley's question to ask, well, maybe she deviated from that because she was intoxicated. Maybe. But I don't think, again, that's when you look at the
Her question was, as I recall it, how valuable is it? That was her question.
I think it's extremely valuable because pretty strong speculation that because she was intoxicated, she got in and moved the seat back away from her normal position. That's, I think, a stretch.
How valuable is that testimony and information in relation to Mr. Monahan's admission that he was driving?
Oh, I think those are the two most compelling bits of information. I think if we didn't have Mr. Monahan's repeated admissions, including what he did at the hospital, remember now, he's post-surgery, he's taken off sedation. He asks for a piece of paper. He can't speak because he's intubated, but he asks the nurse for a piece of paper, unprompted. He writes down that he remembers what happened, he was driving. So those two pieces, I think, are the linchpin of the state's harmless error argument. If we just had a battle of experts, I think this would be a different case.
So, and I'm presuming you would say that the weight of that kind of evidence has to weigh into whether we find exclusion of the GPS evidence to be harmless error.
Correct. Right.
So how do we calibrate that? What words do we use to say, well, you know, we have this really weighty evidence here of the admission, and then we have this kind of inferential light kind of evidence that suggests that maybe if you really wanted to, you squint hard enough, you could see the facts differently. How do we put that into words in a standard?
Well, I think the way the court does that is, as it does in harmless error cases, it is asked to weigh, among other things, the strength of the evidence and the relevance of the, in this case, excluded evidence. In some cases, it would be improperly admitted evidence, but here it's excluded. The relevance, you know, what effect would that excluded evidence have on the state's strong evidence?
Right. So in doing that, essentially what we're doing is trying to put ourselves in the in the shoes of the jury, or at least looking over their shoulder and
to
saying,
some extent,
well, what would you do without this?
I think to some extent that's inevitable when the court is looking at the evidence. It's not clearly it's something more than just was there sufficient evidence, but looking as a reasonable juror, how strong was the evidence? What effect would the excluded evidence have had on that very strong evidence?
On page 31 of your brief, this is the test you set forth, as I understand it. Given the nature and strength of the state's case, so the court's looking at, the way you say it, just the state, it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have convicted Monahan even if it had heard the excluded evidence about the speed of the vehicle. Therefore, the exclusion was harmless.
Yeah, that was a shorthand because I also, that was my conclusion, but I also, before getting to that point, said, let's look at the effect of the excluded evidence, how it would not have had any impact on the seat position evidence on Mr. Monahan's statement. So that was my shorthand summation. That was not my entire argument.
Well, in the previous paragraphs, you say you'd look at whether the jury believed all this. But where do you have, or maybe you want to state it now, your test on harmless error? Because this case and involves, what test are we going to apply? I mean, it's hard enough to state the test and then even harder to apply it, right?
Well, in terms of the test to apply.
Yeah, you then refer to Steets, and to way of saying the same thing.
Yes, and the state, Justice Bradley, you asked early in opposing counsel's presentation, you asked, what are we doing with this case? And to the extent that the court is examining what the test is for harmless error, I think that's a settled issue in the state.
It's a settled issue that it's hard to describe.
It's hard to describe.
Even harder to apply.
And
then every 5, 8, 10 years, it comes back again.
Yes.
Isn't that true?
That is. But at this point, I think it is as settled as it could be, short of some basis to change the law. I mean, it's the state's view that the law is settled. This involves the application of these facts. I mean, the state's view is the court could say this case was improvidently granted. But I think there is some benefit to saying, for the court to say, well, we can't look at all the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant. That's not the test. Because the court looks at many things, including the strength of the state's evidence, and there is no basis in existing case law in this state or any other jurisdiction in the country that I'm aware of or opposing counsel is aware of that is the test.
But the court can't get into a position of weighing the evidence and retrying the case and being the jury.
Well, the court is not the jury. The court is asking what a reasonable jury would do.
Let's pretend we're a reasonable jury, and then what would we do if we were the reasonable jury? That's really the test. It's not stated that way, but that's really the test, isn't it?
I'm sorry, I spoke over the last part of your statement.
Isn't it really the test?
I think the court is looking to trying to determine what a reasonable jury would do, given all this evidence. That's correct. If there are no other questions, I will thank you.
Thank you.
Agree with the amicus brief statement of the harmless error test, Mr. Hinkle?
I think so.
They use the Chapman test. It's on pages 4 and 6 of the green brief.
Yeah, I mean, so Mr. Hennick, I think largely in his brief is in agreement with what I'm saying, except that he's trying to sort of analytically divide the error from the rest of the evidence in the case. And I see the value of that, although, I agree with the state that, you know, the strength of the evidence against the defendant, or not just against the defendant, but the overall balance of the evidence in the case matters. I think there can be cases where, where it's an extremely close call to begin with, and so any error of, you know, of relatively minor dimension could be not harmless, whereas there could be cases where the evidence is just so overwhelming that even a more significant error a reasonable jury could not find for the defendant even in that view. So I don't think you can completely separate out the rest of the evidence in the case from the error, from the evidence that would have been introduced or excluded because of the error.
But if that's the case, doesn't that just lead us back to where we've always been, which is we're not reading every inference in the defendant's favor because we can't. We have to account for these other factors, the relative weight of the state's case versus the claimed error. So are you actually suggesting a different way of handling this analysis than what we've always done?
I guess, you know, and that was an argument that the state made, and I don't quite understand it. It seems to me that obviously, the evidence that was presented to the jury is a relevant consideration. The question is, how does this court look at that evidence when it's deciding whether the error was harmless?
Right. We look at the strength of the state's case. We look at the claimed error. We try to figure out what kind of effect that had on the jury, right? And that's what we've done.
I guess what I'm arguing is that the process of looking at the strength of the state's case involves consideration of multiple ways that a jury could view the evidence. And if there are ways that the jury could view the evidence that would lead to reasonable doubt in light of the error, then this court has an obligation to say that it was not a harmless error.
But that's, I mean, how do we do that? Any given case that you have, the jury could analyze the evidence in almost an infinite variety of ways. And they will all resolve to one of two conclusions, guilty or not, right? But the way they get there, you can't even count the numbers the number of ways they could get there. So as we look at all these inferences, yes, that suggests there are other paths that the jury could travel in arriving at one of those two conclusions. But they're always going to arrive at one of those two conclusions. And what are we supposed to do with the significance of the path they take to get there?
I mean, I guess I don't see any alternative. Like, I don't understand how, you know, when you're looking again at a sort of a whole panoply of facts and trying to decide what's within the realm of reasonable possibility, what's within the realm that a jury could say, yeah, I have a doubt about this, and that doubt would be reasonable. I don't see how you can really analyze that without thinking about what inferences could be drawn that would not support the state or that would go in favor of the defendant. I don't see how you can logically reach the conclusion that no reasonable jury could find for the defendant without thinking about what a reasonable jury could do.
So is the solution to just say that we do the Hunt analysis, but in the process of doing that, we consider inferences as well?
I mean, I think it's sort of inherent in any analysis of the evidence in a case that you're considering inferences.
I think so, too.
And so, yeah, I think the inferences that the court pays special attention to in this analysis have to be the ones that could lead, again, a reasonable jury to find reasonable doubt. And if that collection of inferences is there and supported by whatever, again, evidence would be included or excluded had the error not occurred, then I think unless the court puts the case before an actual jury, then what it's really doing is deciding the case as a jury would, which is not what harmless error is supposed to be about.
Well, tell us how to do it differently. I mean, we'll get our chance.
That's right, we will.
Should I tell you how to do it
differently?
She's just kidding you. Thank you very much.
I was going to ask a question, but I see it's good.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very interesting case, and harmless error is an old doctrine we've used many times, but every case is a little bit different. So thank you for fine briefs and for a very good argument. We are adjourning, and we will get together in closed conference at 3:05. We are adjourned.